Oh boy, it's 1 o'clock back on this live stream podcast and whatever. Took my time off, which, hey, take your time off. Like, I'm one of the worst. A few years ago, I literally worked myself into a cardiac event for no real reason. Like, I didn't make money to retire on or anything else. It was just because I couldn't say no to things. So my, you know, humble advice to y'all would be, if you can, take your time off. Because you sure as hell deserve it, and the business will continue on without you. The world continues on. It's better to take your time, enjoy it. I went to golf in Pinehurst. It was amazing. I had a blast. Played with a bunch of really good friends of mine. Played awesome first day. Played like shit later on, but still could have been fun overall. Wouldn't change it for the world. Anyway. Let us start getting into interesting things instead of me just talking about, you know, my time off. And I'm going to keep moving here because there's plenty of things going on. And it would be not cool of me to delay that. Yeah. And look, some folks are going to post things on here that they want to comment and talk about different pieces of frameworks or whatever. If you do, I'm always glad to talk with somebody about it. So, you know, if you're out there and you want to talk about zero trust or you want to bash the market around it or you want to just rage about ZT, whatever, cool. Let's jump on a podcast and record it. Everybody's opportunity is here and everyone should have the opportunity to say what they want to say. So like I said, I am glad to jump on and debate or chat with somebody or whatever else. So DM me directly and I will set up a recording, because what do you know, you might be the folks that have the key to the kingdom or something along those lines. So let's do that. Okay, there is an article that started out, and let me find the actual report here. Actually, let me start slightly different. So if you're not aware, the government managed to pass a funding bill vehicle that came out. It's 1,000 pages. I got up really early this morning and read through it. Interestingly enough, there's only 33 mentions of the term cybersecurity in here. Now, it does talk about what money's going where. So let me read some specific stuff here for you. And again, if you're a citizen, all this stuff gets published. Do your research and go read it up. But the money they've allocated for basically paying government people, $36,500,000, which is going to be divided among different salaries. And then you go a little further into this and you start seeing that where the money for like CISA goes and those types. So Office of the National Cyber Director looks like they're getting $21 million for their budget, which is a decent chunk of change. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency operations and support in total. Now, here's where numbers get pretty big, right? So CISA's operations support budget, $2,382,814,000. Yeah, so that's a large chunk of change. If you also go through here and look at what they're doing for construction, procurement, and other things, it's $489 million. So there's a pretty good chunk of cheddar going to CISA. I don't think that they should say that they need more money for anything else in the near future. As always, I'll put the links to the stuff at the end of it, but that is not a little bit of dollars. That's a lot. $2 billion is pretty substantial. So there's also some stuff here about different allocations for different monies going to different places. It talks about which budget opportunities are available. But the majority of what I see in here, and again, it's 1,000-something pages, is going to allocate funds to CISA. So, you know, there's a lot of other things that need help, a lot of other agencies, a lot of other groups. I hope, because I didn't see it in here. Again, I searched for cyber, I searched for grants, those types of whatever. I hope that there's money being allocated for those organizations as well. So yeah, let's make sure that we do that. It said that the Biden administration had offered, I think, $1 billion in total for cyber based on whatever, but it's over two. I mean, just two something just for CISA. So there's some money there. You know, that's some dollars. That's your tax dollars at work if you're an American citizen. If you're not an American citizen, that's our tax dollars at work, I guess. There's an article, CISA published this as well. So this is more of a advisory. So PRC state-sponsored cyber activity, actions for critical infrastructure leaders. PRC do this basically is what this is. Summary. So provides an overview of executive for executive leaders on the risk response of from the PRC from Volt Typhoon. CISA, along with the NSA and Federal Bureau of Investigation and other U.S. government and international partners, released a major advisory on February 7th, in which the U.S. is authoring agencies warn cybersecurity defenders that Volt Typhoon has been pre-positioning themselves. Notice that that's a key word. They're pre-positioning themselves on U.S. critical infrastructure. What do they mean by pre-positioning? They mean that they're getting themselves installed and getting ready to act. They're there. They're waiting for something to go down. So that's in, it's critical infrastructure. Let's see what's coming in this year that possibly could be something that you would want to act and cause disruption. I wonder if there's like an election thing or something or other. And it literally says in here, they're doing this, and I'm quoting, to enable disruption or destruction of critical services. So this CISA advisory here provides detailed information on the group's activity, and it tells them basically what to do, effectively apply detection and hardening best practices. Holy shit, if you haven't already been doing this, isn't that illegal? Like, don't we have organizations and fines and all kinds of stuff that's supposed to be making this a thing, but it still is even an option problem. Talks about securing your supply chain. I would argue that it's probably too late to do that. If they're already there and they're already embedded and they're already ready to act, how are you going to go back in time and it's like secure an insecure supply chain? So I think that one's kind of a waste of time and effort, to be perfectly frank. Really, the best practices is what should be focused on here. Key best practices for your cybersecurity teams include ensuring logging, your logging stuff anyway, including for access and security, so identity and access management. Applications, systems, and logs are stored in a central system. They also mean backups and whatever else, but it does talk about things like multi-factor authentication. It talks about micro-segmentation, those types of things. So good advisory, go read it. But again, there's some, I guess you'd call it double talk going on here, which is not necessarily totally useful or helpful. Also, there was a publication that came out yesterday, which this was weird to me. I don't know what other people think about it, but it just is slightly confusing and leans more towards bureaucratic shenanigans than anything. The EPA, yeah, those folks, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, Biden-Harris administration engages states on safeguarding water sector infrastructure against cyber threats. Okay. Today, March 19th, the EPA administrator, Michael Reagan, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan sent a letter to all U.S. governors inviting state environmental health and homeland security secretaries to a convening by their deputies to discuss the urgent need to safeguard water sector critical infrastructures against cyber threats. Duh. This meeting will highlight current. So this is like, let's have a meeting about a meeting for the sake of a meeting, because we need to make sure we have a meeting. This virtual meeting will take place on Thursday, March 21st, which is today. It's supposed to be going on right now from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern. Drinking water and wastewater systems are a lifeline for communities. Yeah, water is pretty damn important. The Biden administration has built our national security approach on the foundational integration of foreign and domestic policy, which means elevating our focus on cross-cutting challenges like cybersecurity. We've worked across government to implement significant cybersecurity standards in our nation's critical infrastructure, including in the water sector. But I just read something about the issue that you're having with critical infrastructure not being criticalized or secured correctly. So, I mean, why is the EPA getting involved in here? This is, yeah, the EPA is kind of an agency that's affiliated with this, but isn't this adding another level of bureaucracy for the sake of adding another level of bureaucracy? Like, does anyone really think that by having the EPA involved, it's going to suddenly make stuff better? I would argue not, but okay, that's just my two cents. Talos has published information on Tiny Turlas, which is kind of fun to say, post-compromise activity, which reveals the full kill chain. Basically, what you should take away from this is kind of a breakdown of how to defend yourself from Tiny Turla. Tiny Turla. A Russian espionage group. There's information on the kill chain the actor uses, including TTPs. So Talos analysis and coordinated with cert.ngo reveals that Turla infected multiple systems in the compromised network of an NGO. The attackers compromised the first system, established presence, and added exclusions to antivirus products running on these endpoints as part of their preliminary post-compromise actions. So they got on, figured out what AV was there, added exceptions, lets them establish themselves, and lets them do other things. Turla then opened additional channels of communication via Chisel, which I had never heard of Chisel, but interesting, for data exfiltration and to pivot to additional accessible systems of the network. So tunneling and those types of things, pretty common stuff. you can read through this. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but it's valuable. If you see any of these, especially when they start talking about the Windows Defender exclusions, that's a problem on your system. So go check it out. Go look for this stuff. But the way that they deliver this is pretty common, you know, emails and phishing and whatever else. It talks about the batch files. Chisel was interesting. So on deployment, Chisel will set up a reverse proxy tunnel to an attacker through an attacker control box, and it gives actually the channel and IP address and everything there. We've observed that the attackers leverage the Chisel connection to the initially compromised system to pivot. Okay, so tunneling. The presence of Windows remote management based connections on the target system indicates that Chisel was likely used in conjunction with other tools such as proxy chains and evil WinRM to establish remote sessions. WinRM is Microsoft's implementation of the WS management protocol. You should know this if you're a Microsoft administrator. It allows Windows based systems to exchange information be administered using scripts or built-in utilities. So there's a breakdown of how all this stuff goes in there. This is valuable. I would say that nothing of this other than the fact that Chisel was introduced is totally new to me. But then again, there's a lot smarter people than me out there. So go check this out. Again, if you see anything here, especially these specific file calls and whatnot and the IP addresses and whatever, you have a problem on your network. You need to deal with it because that's no bueno. Justice.gov has published an article about an Idaho man pleads guilty to hacking computers of the city of Noonan. That was the guy from Caddyshack, right? Remember the putt? Noonan and a Griffin Medical Clinic. So basically, Robert Purbeck, and his online names are LifeLock and Studmaster. Obviously, he's not that Studmaster if he got owned and arrested. He'll be Studmaster in prison. Who hacked the computer servers of the city of Noonan and the Griffin Medical Clinic and then targeted 17 other victims across the United States in the process stealing information from more than 132,000 individuals, pled guilty today to federal charges of computer fraud and abuse. Breached computer systems in the district and across the country, stole vast amounts of personal information and aggravated his crimes by weaponizing sensitive data in an egregious attempt to extort his victims. And he was stupid enough to do this while living in the United States. So sucks for you, pal, if you were in like Moldova or somewhere else, you would have basically got away scot-free. According to the U.S. Attorney Buchanan, the charges and other information presented in court, Purbeck purchased access. So we went on the underground, purchased access to computers on the server of a Griffin, Georgia medical clinic on a dark net marketplace. So he didn't even hack it himself. He bought it and got access. He then used the stolen credentials to gain unauthorized access to other computers of the medical clinic and stole medical records. So he violated HIPAA, which contains sensitive personal information of 43,000 individuals. Let's see. So on August 31st, agents executed a federal search warrant in his home in Meridian, Idaho. During the search, they seized multiple computers and devices where they found a whole lot of stuff. And it looks like as part of his plea agreement, which I don't even think they should allow a plea agreement, but whatever, Purbeck agreed to pay $1 million in restitution to these victims. Now, the question I would have, does he have $1 million to actually pay this stuff back? Or is this a plea thing of like, I'm super sorry and I promise I'll pay $1 million and then I declare bankruptcy and no one gets paid? How about you just throw his ass in prison because he kind of deserves to go to jail? Like, you commit a crime, you should go do the time and then take their money. Sure. The Record by Recorded Future, which has a lot of great content, has an article from Alexander Martin, which was published yesterday. Hackers claim to have breached Israeli nuclear facilities' computer network. That's super comforting. Always good to know. An Iran-linked hacking group claims to have breached the computer network of a sensitive Israeli nuclear installation in an incident declared by the anonymous hackers. Not the group Anonymous, but literally the folks that don't want to be known. Hackers as a protest against the war in Gaza. The hackers claim to have stolen and published thousands of documents, including PDFs, emails, PowerPoint slides from the Shimon Peres Negev Nuclear Research Center, the secretive facility which houses a nuclear reactor linked to Israel's unavowed nuclear weapons programs, has historically been targeted by Hamas rockets. So rockets weren't doing the trick. They pivoted to cyber. In a social media message explaining their intentions, the group claimed, as we are not, and this is their translation, we are not as like as the bloodthirsty Netanyahu and his terrorist army, we carried out the operation in such a way that no civilians were harmed. But you hacked a nuclear facility. So Despite this statement and other social media messages, the group said it did not intend to have a nuclear explosion. Okay, but this operation is dangerous and anything might happen. All right. Alongside an animated video depicting a nuclear detonation and a call for the evacuation of the nearby city of Dimona and the town of Yeraham, something like that. The Israeli embassy in London did not respond to a request for comment. Gil Messing, the chief of staff at Israeli cybersecurity company Checkpoint, told Recorded Futures company was aware of the group and was established on Twitter and Telegram accounts around the start of the country's war with Hamas. Checkpoint has mostly observed these hackers echoing attacks carried out by Iranian groups, so suggesting that there might also be the same groups operating under different foreign names. The Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs did not respond for a request to comment. Shocker. Attacking nuclear facilities, nothing can possibly go wrong there, right? not cool. Bleeping Computer has got, if you have Firebase, listen to this. Like, if you know people are doing things with Firebase in your systems, listen to this. So, misconfigured Firebase instances leaked 19 million plain text passwords. And this is from Yonut Alasku, I think. Three cybersecurity researchers discovered close to 19 million plain text passwords exposed on the public internet by misconfigured instances of Firebase, a Google platform for hosting databases, cloud computing, and app development. Lots of people use Firebase. The trio of researchers scanned 5 million domains with a script that they wrote, so that's how easy it was, and found 916 websites for organizations that either had no security rules enabled or had set them up incorrectly. There's a twist to this coming in a second, so listen to this. More than 125 million sensitive user accounts were found, Jesus, including emails, names, passwords, phone numbers, and billing information with bank details. Yeah, I mean, all that stuff's already been hacked 7 times over, but still. The researchers started looking on the public web for PII exposed Firebase instances. Most of the sites had write enabled, which is bad. You don't want write enabled. For each exposed database, the script, which I won't even give the name of the script here because you could go do it and, you know, do bad things here. Check for the type of data available, extracted a sample of 100 records, and they have screenshots of the data. All the details were organized in private databases that offer an overview and numbers of the sensitive user information. So 84 million names, 106 million emails, 33 million phone numbers, 20 million passwords, billing and bank information, and invoices for 27 million different interactions. For passwords, the problem gets worse as 98% of them are in plain text, not encrypted, not even scrambled, nothing. The researcher told us that companies must have gone, and this is a quote, out of their way to store the password in plain text because Firebase from Google has an end-to-end identity solution that called Firebase Authentication specifically to make sure that there is a secure sign-in process that does not expose user passwords in the records. So the question for me is, if you have this capability and you have this default configuration and Google's done what it's done and people have gone out of their way to make sure that those security controls are not in place and now there are exposed things, does that not meet the standard for negligence or circumventing security controls? Like if someone had built an airplane and went out of their way to make sure that one of the fucking engines didn't work, wouldn't that be a problem? Shouldn't someone be responsible? And just to kind of drive this point a little further home, let's go look at Firebase instances via Shodan. And again, this didn't take me long. I found about 700 in the US. I dialed in a little bit more. I see 177 of them that have got pretty blatant misconfigurations. And from looking here, some of these things are tied to pretty old operating systems. So let's see if I can find any organizations that are here, which would be of interest very quickly, just because why not? I mean, this is part of the fun of having access to this stuff. So looks like a lot of it is floating around through AWS, obviously a lot of Google, other hosting providers, University of California, Santa Barbara. So you've got a misconfigured thing here. I would go fix it. Brander Group, Inc., City of Fort Worth. Now, City of Fort Worth, your folks over in Dallas were just recently hit. You guys should go check on this as well. And if you do a little bit of further digging, I'm not going to get myself in trouble here, but oh my God, City of Fort Worth, please go fix this because you're in a bad place. Wow. Yeah, definitely not good. I'll make sure I notify them and they'll send me a cease and desist letter, but you know, what am I going to do? I wish that it was not the way that it is, but it is the way that it is. Yeah. Akamai, whatever you want to call them, they published a pretty interesting thing, abusing the DHCP administrators group to escalate privileges in Windows domains. Now, excuse me, I got a little bit of, you know, coffee burp going on. That's gross. It's always better to keep it down than try it for the third time. Abusing this DHCP administrators group. This sounds like something new, but it's really not. Like, from red team perspective, whatever else, this is kind of where you're trying to get to. Akamai researchers discovered a new privilege escalation technique. So the technique is new, but not the actual operational sort of approach for AD that leverages the DHCP administrators group in cases where DHCP server role is installed on a domain controller, which is super great. If you can get to a domain controller, this could or should or will enable them to gain domain admin privileges, which is bad. The technique is based on the abuse of legitimate features and doesn't rely on any vulnerability. Okay, therefore, a fix doesn't exist. Sure, but the fix would be better management, but yeah, okay. In addition to providing a privilege escalation primitive, the same technique could also be used to create a stealthy domain persistence mechanism, which is bad. That's what you call establishing a foothold. Microsoft DHCP server is very popular, pretty much everywhere. It was observed running 40% of networks monitored by Akamai. Any environment running the server could be vulnerable. So if you're doing Microsoft stuff and you have DHCP, I would go check. They provide some detailed steps here. So basically, it gives the run through on how to do this. What are DHCP administrations, abusing the options? It goes through the specifics of the proxy stuff that they put in, DNS server configuration. There's a lot here. It's a really well-written piece of content. But for the long and short of it is, I could cover this for the next hour. Go check your stuff. This is not a good thing to have out there, which would cause compromise. So do that. Go check it. Go fix it. Go do those things. State scoop. Cybersecurity grant match requirement. A steep mountain to climb for states. Yeah, states. Why did I say stapes? States. Federal officials said the rising cost of participating in the state and local cybersecurity grant program could be tough for states over the next 2 years. I've tried to participate in grants lately. I've worked with folks that have tried to get in the grant program. It's a colossal pain in the ass. Now, here's some specifics that come here. So there's a $1 billion grant program created by the 2021 infrastructure law and jointly administered by FEMA and CISA. Now, this is designed to so that states gradually pay a higher percentage of the program costs as federal dollars diminish and they move over to the state side of it. So in the first year of the program, 90% of the funds came from the federal government. Only the state only had to cover 10%, but the split now is going to 80-20, then 70-30, then 60-40, blah, blah, blah. 3% of the $1 billion was set aside for tribal nations, which is kind of rough and not really cool. But the whole thing of it is here, if you haven't gone through the grant sort of process, it should be way easier to get grant money. It shouldn't be this miserable. And honestly, the way that they're awarding this stuff is a little bit suspect, to be perfectly frank. It's not open well to small businesses and real innovators. If you're a giant company with 50 people that you can throw at this problem, you can get those grants. And you can go look, like if you go to CISA.gov and go look for the state and local cybersecurity grant program, it talks about it. Let's see, CISA and FEMA have announced the availability of $374.9 million for FY 2023, which is going to end not too soon, but a little bit out there. And you can go start figuring out how to apply for this stuff. Application process and timeline. It goes through the specifics here. Requirements, assessments, evaluations. It's a colossal ass pain. And this is part of the problem why more of this stuff is not getting fixed, to be perfectly honest, because it shouldn't be this miserable to get a grant for solving a problem. But that's just my thoughts. Tell me what you think. The Marine Corps has published their Zero Trust roadmap for the next couple of years. And it's interesting the way that they're approaching this problem. Here's a quote from the person that's actually doing this. We looked at both the threshold and the objective requirements of Zero Trust and in terms of what the capabilities are that are currently available on the Marine Corps Enterprise Network. And then how do I push that to the tactical edge? So they're working on this. They're putting it in place. They talk about their priorities. And you can kind of follow through here. The Marines are moving from, for example, 17 different cloud instances that supported disparate networks, like the ones used for the Marine Expeditionary Forces, to consolidating them and then having more control, blah, blah, blah. Point being, I'm retired Navy, so I can say this, like, if the Marines can do it, jokey, jokey, anybody can do it. So go read this article. There's some good pros in here. And for the haters of ZT or whatever out there, like, it's a strategy. It's something, it's a name. Yes, there's marketing stuff that goes on with it, whatever. The reality of it is if you engage in the actual requirements of the approach, you can get some value from it. Just like, I don't know, working out is a strategy. You could market that shit too, but it's really got things that you have to do in order to be effective and to go and do the right exercises that will provide you benefit. It's not the best corollary, but I'm just saying. CyberScoop had this article, FCC approved cybersecurity label for consumer devices. I'm so glad that my tax dollars are going to this waste of money. The U.S. Cyber Trustmark aims to provide consumers with a better understanding of the security of their IoT devices. Oh, shit. The Federal Communications Commission voted Thursday to approve the U.S. Cyber Trustmark, a voluntary label. Voluntary, there's part of the problem. That denotes that consumer Internet of Things devices like smart home appliances meet baseline security standards. Define the baseline security standards for me. The FCC approval is the culmination of a White House initiative, which I have a link to that right here, and is somewhat modeled after the energy efficiency labeling program Energy Star, which is kind of BS. But anyway, the program would create an easy-to-recognize label that confirms for consumers that a product meets cybersecurity standards developed by NIST. The hope is that consumers can vote with their wallet and move the consumer market to address the litany of vulnerabilities found in smart devices. So, wow. This is a great way to basically punt off responsibility for this for manufacturers and whatever, and sort of say, well, you, the buyer, tell us how we should secure stuff. I don't agree with this. If your car explodes, and this is a quote from their publication here. If your car explodes following a minor accident, everybody heard of the Pinto, or if a table saw comes loose and maims you, or your light bulb overheats and causes a fire, you can take the negligent manufacturer to court and recover your damages. But if an attacker hacks your smart home device, let's say an Alexa, you have little to no recourse against the manufacturer. Okay. I mean, I don't know what people think about this. I would say that I kind of disagree with it. I get the concept, but this seems like a great way for manufacturers to find an out. ABC News, murder suspect mistakenly released from jail after cybersecurity incident. Yeah, 30-year-old Zion River Shaka has been in Fulton County Jail since 2020. Authorities in Georgia are searching for 30-year-old murder suspect Zion River Shaka, who was mistakenly released by Clayton County authorities last week. Last week, Shaka was transferred from the Fulton County Jail and sent to the custody of Clayton County Sheriff's Office for a scheduled hearing with instructions to return to Fulton County Jail. However, there was a mistake and he was released after the recording, cybersecurity-wise. This week, officials said courts and other systems, Georgia's most populous county, were hacked over the weekend. So basically what I get out of this, and there's not a whole lot of specifics here, but it's just interesting that this person was in jail, was sent somewhere else to do a hearing. Somehow or another, the systems got hacked in that sort of timeline. And then some manipulation of those systems occurred and someone at the county sheriff's office goes, oh, we should release this person. And so now they're a murder suspect that is out free because of a cybersecurity thing. So I guess here's a follow-on question. If that murder suspect got out because of a cybersecurity thing and there is a CISO and there is those people in charge there, and that murder suspect goes off and murders someone else, are they liable for that? Who's responsible for that? Is that just another cyber oopsie or what? Good questions to ask, because apparently this is actually a thing to, you know, put out there now. Problematic, if you ask me. I for the longest time have thought that the court system is exceptionally vulnerable to hacking and manipulation. And if you know how courts work, the moment you introduce doubt or you introduce flaws into that system, the whole thing falls over on itself, because then you don't have any truth or veracity or validation going on. So that's a problem. Here's a great example of a digital system that's supposed to keep people, I guess, safe, you know, locked up, that are supposed to be locked up. Somebody messed with it, and then this cat gets out. If they do murder somebody else or hurt somebody else or steal something or do anything illegal, who's liable? Obviously, they would be liable, but then they screwed up and let them out. So good questions to ask. Anyway, I covered a lot of ground. It's been 30 minutes. Folks got other things to do. If you're on the live stream, I appreciate you being here. I will post a link up to another charity thing that I'm doing at RSA. If you've ever wanted to see someone pretty much, you know, jump off a bridge and ruin their career, this is probably it for me. So I'll be unemployed after this, I think. But we're raising money for a veterans charity that is not one of these BS ones. It literally goes to people that I know that are doing great things for veterans with PTSD and alternative treatments. So if you can, donate $2, donate $3, whatever. Go donate one half of what you would spend at Starbucks today, and we can help veterans. 22 veterans a day, I think the number's a little low, commit suicide. This is a great way for us to help others. So as always, thank you for jumping on. I'm Chase Cunningham, Dr. Cunningham, Dr. Zero Trust, lots of doctors there. Stay smart, stay safe, stay secure. I will catch you on the next one. Disclaimer, the information in this podcast episode, aka episode, is provided for general information purposes only. By listening to this episode, you understand that this is not specific technical guidance from the host. No information contained in this episode should be construed as security advice from the author, host, or guest, nor is it intended to be a substitute for security advice on any particular subject matter. No listener of this episode should act or refrain from acting on the basis of any information included in or accessible through this episode without seeking the appropriate technical or other professional advice on the particular facts and circumstances that are discussed. This podcast is for informational purposes only. All views expressed therein are those of the host and his guest and should not be considered as being endorsed by nor related to the host or the guest's employers.